This show furnished by Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. It's time for Gervie's Law, the intersection of law and life, with your host, injury compensation attorney, author, and mentor, Alan Gervie. Alan is managing attorney at the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn, a workers' compensation law firm who have represented injured workers for over 35 years. Joined today by his co-host, radio personality, and television host, Carrie Kasem. Carrie brings a fresh, real perspective to the intersection of law and life, turning Murphy's Law upside down. And now, here are Alan Gervie and Carrie Kasem.
Good afternoon, Los Angeles. And everyone listening around the world on KBC.com, I am Alan Gervie. And I am the managing partner of the law firm of Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn. And today, as usual, I am in beautiful Culver City, California, at the studios of KBC to be the managing partner of your life. We all need management in our life. I wish I could say that we could do it on our own, but it's really difficult. It's really tough. Use the support around you. Use your friends, your family. Tell them what's going on in your life. Stay tight with your friends and your family. You can do it. I know you can. I've just turned into a motivational speaker. Lawyer extraordinaire. I am now Tony Robbins. You can do it. You can do it. Carrie Kasem is with me today.
Cool Moss. Cool Moss. Cool Moss. Cool Moss. Do you know what that's from?
Absolutely not.
Okay, it's when you do like the fire walk with me with Tony Robbins, which I did with my brother and sister, and we had to walk over 12 feet of hot burning coals, and the whole time in your head for hours before you're thinking cool moss, cool moss, and you're really thinking you're stepping on cool moss, and you can walk across those coals without getting burned. I know, I did.
You know, I was at my friend's pool last week, and they had artificial grass, and I was walking over that stuff, and I'll tell you, it is so hot. It's like walking on coals. So I kind of know what you're talking about.
It's just like that.
I totally
just
get
like
motivated.
Fake grass.
Totally motivated. I'll tell you what a week we've had. A lot of stuff in the news. And we have a great show, by the way. Don't miss our show. If you're going to turn off the radio, don't even think about it. If you're driving in traffic, don't even think about going for lunch or for dinner or to the pool. Listen to Scott Turow. He will be on in a few minutes. Scott Turow is an author extraordinaire. He's had over 10 best-selling works of fiction. And you might know him from Presumed Innocent, which was a great movie with Harrison Ford, or The Burden of Proof, Identical, Innocent. And he's got a new book coming out. Well, it's actually out. It's called Testimony. And we're going to talk to Scott about his prolific writing career, and he's, of course, an attorney, because this is a law show, Carrie. He is a lawyer. He went to Harvard Law School. But before we talk about that, let's talk about Kathy Griffin. Did she go to Harvard Law School?
I don't think so. I don't. I feel like she didn't have any education, especially in
that's
manners.
That's not nice.
No.
You're going to have to do a press conference and apologize.
Oh, right.
For saying she has no education.
And I'll hire Lisa Bloom to be right by my side.
Lisa Bloom is a good pal of mine. She's been on this show. She's actually sat in the chair that Carrie's sitting in. Her mother, Gloria Allred, was on the show.
Her mother's amazing. What an amazing woman. We've had her in here a couple times. Incredible attorney. Probably, I don't know if she would have taken on this.
Is there a case here? Did I miss something?
Yeah, I guess, you know, the
Kathy Griffin has a case. Who is she suing? Who is she getting sued by? Is she being prosecuted? Why does she have a lawyer?
Donald Trump is angry, and the kids are angry. You know, if somebody took a picture of my father's head bloodied and cut off, I'd go after her too, with a vengeance, and I wouldn't stop.
And you've gone after your stepmother with a vengeance, and she didn't even do that.
Well, she did, just didn't hold it.
Did you lawyer up?
I sure did. Okay. And I sure have a case against her.
Okay, so, but talking to Kathy Griffin. What is the case? I'm confused. I'm a lawyer.
It's not a case, and I hope her entire career goes downhill like it is, and it continues to go downhill. You don't do that. I don't care what country you're from. Yes, we are in a country that is free, and we have, you know, Second Amendment rights. We can say and do whatever, but there are consequences. There are consequences, and people forget that. Well, I can say whatever, sure, but people can hate you too, and they may not like what you have to say, and they can condemn you and destroy your career, and that's what is happening to her, and she deserves every bit of it.
No, but the answer is to do a press conference. That's right, what we all should do.
Yeah, blaming the president for being upset and saying he's the most powerful man is trying to ruin my life. That press conference, I was stunned. I sat with my jaw dropped, my eyes wide. Like, how dare you? That's what it felt like. Like, how dare you come out with this lawyer who's saying
what do you mean this lawyer? Lisa Bloom, that's my co-host.
I'm going to take the fifth on this one. I played the fifth. If we're going to do lawyer terms, I
have remember
no
when we did the show with Lisa Bloom and Gloria Allred on Mother's Day? Now, Mother's Day just took place last week. I mean, a few weeks ago, of course, on my birthday.
Yeah, I do.
And that was a beautiful show. And, you know, just
Gloria was amazing.
Well, they both were really great. I like to talk to them on our show under better circumstances where there's actually a legal case. I'm really into the law.
Yeah.
That's what I do as a lawyer. So I'm not sure that press conferences when there's been no case filed where people are lawyering up for no reason. I mean, make your apologies on
Twitter.
Would you have
stood by Kathy? If she hired you and paid you a lot of money, would you have stood by Kathy Griffin and said the things that Lisa said?
I represent people who need me to represent them. I'm not a public relations person, and I'm not
Would you have stood by Kathy Griffin if she came to you and said, I need a lawyer?
No, as I look at all my cases, I judge them on what I can see as a fact. Sometimes I'm wrong, but I don't take a lot of cases because I don't believe in them. But this is not a case. If they wanted a PR person...
So you
person,
wouldn't have taken
what
this
is
case
Twitter
on?
For?
Would
that's
you have
what,
done this? You
that,
have not...
No,
you
absolutely
are
not. Absolutely
thank you,
not.
Thank you.
But Twitter, let her tweet. Don't do press conferences. You know, I want to talk about something that's way more important, really more intellectual, because I don't find this whole press conference thing and what Kathy Griffin's doing at all of interest.
I agree. Wonder Woman came out this weekend, and I'm so excited about that. That's way more important.
Movies.
We're not, no?
What about Presumed Innocent? That was a great movie.
It was so good. Harrison Ford.
Yeah.
Raul Julia.
Yeah.
I remember that.
So that, and then, of course, there's other movies that are crime thrillers, and that's what we're going to talk about today, because we are really honored to have with us a prolific writer and quite an amazing lawyer as well. He sold more than 30 million books around the world, and his books have been translated into over 40 different languages. He, of course, wrote The Burden of Proof, Personal Injuries, Presumed Innocent, as I mentioned, Innocent, Identical, and now he's come up with a new book, which has gotten rave reviews. In fact, the book is called Testimony, and Jeffrey Toobin wrote, Testimony is Scott Turow's most ambitious and complex work, which takes us from the gritty familiarity of the beloved Kendall County into a mysterious world of international intrigue. It's the best kind of thriller, one that stimulates the mind as well as thrilling the heart. My heart is thrilled to welcome to Gervie's Law right now, Scott Turow.
Hey, guys.
Hi.
How are you?
Great.
Good. How are you? You are on this whirlwind tour going all over the country. You're in Milwaukee
that
now.
Is that true? That is true. I'm on my way to Madison, Wisconsin.
Oh, I was there three times last year.
The Mad City.
Yes.
Yeah, this is a book tour which has taken me, not many authors can have this distinction, but it's taken me through not only Madison, Wisconsin, but also Madison, Connecticut. So you don't often get two Madisons on the same tour.
There's also Madison, Indiana, where I spent most of my summers with my mom's side and my grandparents. Little tiny town.
Right?
Yeah, so there's a
three. Wow.
So,
yeah.
Scott, you have a new Madison to get to on this tour. You're in the vicinity. You're going to be in L.A. We are very privileged here in our city to have Scott Turow, and you are going to be here on June 5th, which is
Monday.
and Tuesday. And on Monday, you're going to be at the New Road School, Herb Alpert Educational Village. And if anyone wants to see and talk with Scott, you can get tickets for that event in Santa Monica. And then on June 6th, he'll be at Mission Viejo at the Mission Viejo Library. And that's another opportunity. Scott, we have to ask you, before we get into a lot of stuff, we want to talk about testimony. We want to talk about your work as a lawyer, obviously, for many, many years at Denton's, the law firm. What do you consider yourself, a lawyer first or an author first?
I started out wanting to be a novelist, and I was lucky enough for that to happen. And I definitely regard myself as a writer first. I love practicing law, but it's definitely a blessed life. There's no question about it, to be able to do two things that you really love.
I just hope that your fellow lawyers at Denton's aren't listening, because, of course, you're a partner there, and you were with Sonnenschein, Nathan Rosenthal, which was the precursor for Denton's for many years. And you've done criminal work. You've done civil work. Now, a lot of the work you do there, though, is pro bono, isn't it?
True. Completely true. Yep.
Why is that? You went to law school, Harvard Law School. It's like you're just opening up your heart and helping people?
You know, when I decided to continue to practice law, which was a decision that I made after the success of Presumed Innocent, I thought one good reason to do it was because I would be doing the kinds of things that the young man who had gone to law school would have wanted me to be doing. And that still remains my attitude, that it is, again, a tremendous blessing to be able to practice law without having to make a living at it. And given that fact, and believe me, I don't turn up my nose at paying cases, but I do think it's important for those of us who really are able to afford to do it, in particular, to spend a fair amount of my time practicing, representing poor people. Or, you know, I've also done a lot of time serving on public bodies, and like the Death Penalty Commission here in Illinois. And, those have been good decisions for me personally.
You bring up the Death Penalty Commission. That was under Illinois Governor George Ryan. Why do you have such disdain for the death penalty?
I don't have disdain for the death penalty. As a matter of fact, Alan, I've always said that I don't ridicule anybody's opinions about the death penalty, because I, frankly, have held them all. But And I really mean that. I started out as a young person who, you know, like young people, frequently was very idealistic, and I thought it was a barbaric practice. And then I became a prosecutor, and while I never sort of resolved the argument in my own mind about whether if Tsar of the Universe, that favorite law school phrase, I would have had the death penalty. I certainly felt, as a prosecutor, if I was called upon to ask for capital punishment, I could do that in good conscience, because it was the judgment of my community that that was the appropriate punishment for horrible murders. When I was appointed to the Capital Punishment Commission, I began to ask myself much more constantly, what is the real purpose of this? What are we supposed to be getting out of this as a society? And when I did that, I really came to believe that the death penalty does not give us what we think we want from it. And that's why I'm opposed to it. But I don't deride people who believe in it.
I just want to know, what doesn't it give us? And what I think the problem is it's not done soon enough. So we're paying over and over, and we're letting these people live, and we're paying for all of these, you know, whether it's appeals or they're living in this, you know, they're on death row. And I just feel like if somebody's convicted, okay, appeal, but why does it take so long? Why does it continue on for years and years and years? If somebody's been convicted, you know, and they were caught red-handed, and, you know, as a serial rapist or a serial killer, why aren't they just, boom, why aren't they just taken out? Why does it take so long? That's the only problem I have with it.
I love the way you say boom, because we're going to talk about boom in a minute, but go ahead and answer the question.
Well, I actually think that it's a great question, and it's a frequent question, and it goes to illustrate what the problem is. Because, you know, Justice Potter Stewart said that death is different. And the fact of the matter is that when a legal decision ends up in the termination of another human being's life, the law hesitates. And candidly, I think it should. But that means that you are not going to get these swift executions that people always think in the ideal they would like to have. And, you know, if you want to have a death penalty, then part of it is going to be this elaborated process so that 11 and a half years later, and that's what the average is here in the United States, we find ourselves executing people who, you know, who committed a crime literally more than a decade before.
Right.
And if you don't want to do that, you're not willing to grant the procedures, then you can't have capital punishment.
You know,
there's
Scott,
so many stumbling points.
There are. I lived in Singapore for a year, and I remember that, you know, when you fly in there, in bold red letters, it says death to all drug traffickers. Any of that. And let me tell you something. When I was there, they hung an 18-year-old kid for selling ecstasy, but that was it. I mean, since then, if you carry a gun, or there was somebody, a year before I moved there, somebody had robbed a bank with a fake gun and a woman died of a heart attack, so they put him to death. But there was nobody died because nobody did anything because they knew they were going to be killed if it happened. Don't you think it would save so many more lives and cut the crime down if we just start executing because nobody would do it anymore? It's true though. In the end, nobody would do it because we were executing people right and left.
Oh,
I'm telling you, why does it work in Singapore, but it doesn't work? Why wouldn't it work here in the United States?
Well, you're not telling me how many innocent people got executed in Singapore. You are telling me that it was put to death, which violates our sense of proportion. So if you want a justice system like that, where we cut off hands for stealing loaves of bread, you know, you can certainly make any penal system severe enough that you dramatically reduce the crime rate.
Right.
Right.
You also live with tyranny. Yes.
I agree, and, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, cutting off people's hands or heads.
And they don't do that in
matter.
Singapore.
But, you know,
they don't
I
do
want
that.
To talk about...
But I felt safe walking in my car.
We have to take a break. Carrie, take it to Singapore.
All right.
Scott, you know, something that's much more near and dear to my heart, not that the death penalty isn't an important issue, but midlife crises. And I want to talk about a midlife crisis because a lot of people are getting to the point where they may be facing one. People are in them, or people are past them. And we want to talk about Bill 10 Boom. So if you haven't read Testimony, you need to read it. We need to take a quick break. We're talking to Scott Turow. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
We are all.
Call me Kings, baby.
790 KABC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan Gervey and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
You must be tired of unclogging drains for $99.
No, ma'am. Lots of homeowners like you calling about hot water heaters lately.
I bet you smell good plumbers get a pretty penny for diagnosing these things.
Didn't they tell you? The house call is free for residential homeowners with tank-type water heaters.
No way! Stinky's Rudershard is buku bucks to diagnose our last water heater.
I know. A lot of clients have told me that.
And if I remember right, their guarantee only covers the first year.
Yeah, they use that as the industry standard, but the Mike Diamond standard covers the whole thing. If the hot water heater leaks 5 years and 11 months down the road, we'll install a new one for free, including labor.
That's crazy talk.
It may be crazy, but it's true.
This is Mike Diamond, and I guarantee my plumber will show up on time and smell good, or your house call is free.
Have a smell good plumber diagnose your hot water heater for free. Call 1-800-446-MIKE or check out the hot water heaters page at MikeDiamond.com. Contractor license number 399-170.
The following update is for drivers who pay too much for car insurance due to DUIs, DWIs, or anything else. Serenity Insurance specializes in low-cost SR22 or FR44 auto insurance. We've opened a phone line for very affordable car insurance meant specifically for overpaying high-risk drivers. The quote is free, and we'll handle the filings. Call 800-986-0694, 800-986-0694, 800-986-0694.
As a small business owner, you make every dollar count. So what could you do with $10? Go to Vistaprint.com today, and you'll get 500 high-quality custom business cards for only $9.99. That's less than 2 cents per card. And at Vistaprint, your satisfaction is absolutely guaranteed. So it's never been easier to turn 500 strangers into connections. Just visit Vistaprint.com and use promo code 4141 at checkout. That's Vistaprint.com, promo code 4141.
Love Doug McIntyre, but hate mornings? It's McIntyre in the morning at night.
Or as I like to say, McIntyre after dark.
Mark it on your calendars, Friday night, June 9th from 8 to 10 p.m., a special McIntyre After Dark edition.
Live from the legendary, iconic, delicious Barney's Beanery at the original West Hollywood location.
Come on out and have a cheeseburger, onion rings the size of your head, and every beer on earth.
Beer.
And more beer. Did I mention beer?
I understand. Let's get on with it.
The great Dave Tull Trio will be there, and you can be there. That's McIntyre in the Morning After Dark.
June 9th from 8 to 10 p.m.
Only on News.
Talk Evolved. 790
KBC.
Need some legal, moral, or just common sense advice from a friend? Call Alan Gervey and Kerry Kasem now at 800-222-KABC. That's 800-222-5222.
Yes, that number is 800-222-5222. If you want to talk to Scott Turow, we are talking to Scott Turow, who is an author of over 10 best-selling works, including Identical, Innocent, Presumed Innocent, and The Burden of Proof. And he, of course, wrote the book 1L, an autobiography, on his first year at Harvard Law School. It got it all started in writing. He's a band member of Rock Bottom Remainders, an attorney at Denton's. Scott, with all of that, what are you most proud of?
Oh, you know the standard but sincere answer. My three kids, you know, the families they've made. I really mean it, so...
You always have to ask work-wise. Because
I don't want to ask work.
It's always family.
Because we've had so many people on the show, and we've talked to just about every lawyer you can think of, an entertainer and writer, and a lot of them do not say they're family, believe it or not.
What are you talking about?
But, you know, Scott is a family guy. and, you know, when we talk about that, I want to talk about testimony. Testimony is the new book, and New York Times said this is at once a thriller, a story of middle-aged angst, an exposition of international law, and an exploration of an intensely serious and very nasty episode in recent history. Scott, that's a lot. That's a mouthful. How were you able to put testimony together so that you could bring in all of these issues and have this thriller that people are talking about?
A lot of research, first of all, and probably a lot of experience writing, Alan.
Yeah.
And you know, a really good editor who kept pushing me to make sure that the book succeeded at the first level, which is to say that it's, you know, it's a suspenseful and entertaining read. And so, you know, I can bow in a lot of different directions.
Let's talk about Bill Tenboom, the protagonist. Now, he has a midlife crisis, 54-year-old guy, lawyer. Is there anything that reflects your life? And did you ever have or feel the need to go to The Hague and get onto an international case involving Bosnia?
No, it's not that autobiographical. No, I was in The Hague visiting many years ago, and people suggested to me, you know, you gotta write a book about this place, about the cases in these international tribunals, and usually when people tell me that they've got some major injustice for me to write about, what they're talking about is their divorce case.
but this was bigger than divorce.
Yeah, but this. So this was just one of those things that was on my writer's bucket list and stayed there. And I've learned over time that if I keep thinking about something over a number of years, especially, that it's going to be worth writing about for me.
So did you actually go to the Roma village? And for people who don't know what we're talking about, I don't like to call them gypsies, but, you know, that's basically the group of people called Roma who were in the Bosnia massacre. And the book explains exactly what happened in obviously fictional, but it reflects, I think, something that you did research on and that reflects reality.
Certainly.
So
there were. Did I go to a Roma village in Bosnia? Yes, I did, and had a lot of contacts there, and saw the life up close. And the village that I describe in testimony obviously resembles the real life one, where I spent some time.
And what happened that made you really motivated to really get into the plight of these people who, in the book, are killed en masse? And there's so many twists and turns, basically, with Bill Tenboom, not only as a lawyer, but as a kind of a someone searching in some existential angst. What was it that pulled this together for you and brought out all of these complications and complexities with a final outcome, which we won't talk about here?
Well, I mentioned the writer's bucket list, and understanding more about the Roma or the gypsies has been on that list even longer than writing about the International Criminal Tribunals in The Hague. And I was a young man, and I had a relative dying in a hospital on the west side of Chicago. And at one point when I was in there visiting him, I noticed that there were encampments in every waiting room of local Roma. And I quickly figured out that the local gypsy leader was dying.
And I walked in one morning. There were no Roma left. And I realized that the gypsy leader had died. But it was 40 years ago, and you could still smoke in hospitals. And I noticed that not only were the Roma gone, but so were all of the ashtrays. And I said to myself, wow, what goes on with these people that they would, do some kind of act of, petty theft, which is likely to make them unwelcome in a place that any sensible person knows they're likely to return to in a state of need. And that question always lingered for me. Like, what is it that these people believe? Why are they such dedicated outsiders? And, I have to say, if there is no minority group that I am familiar with who are quite like the Roma.
You know, I was going to... I was sorry to interrupt. I was going to ask you there, and I didn't want to be rude, but I was going to say, were you worried that anything was going to be taken? Did you hold on to your stuff? Did you hide your stuff? Did you lock it in the safe? I know that you hear that. I mean, but that now that you've said that all these ashtrays were stolen, I'm wondering, were you worried?
I don't, I wasn't. Maybe I should have been.
It was probably good that you weren't.
No, I had made contact with the people that I was going to see. I had a wonderful guide and translator, and Diana had been in the village, and I didn't feel unsafe at all. Somebody asked me for a favor while I was there, and I had the feeling that I was being scammed, and of course it turned out that I was being scammed. So, in some ways I would have felt weird if everything I was reading and coming to understand about Roma society, if that wasn't true, if I didn't remain an outsider to them and somebody whom, they could take advantage of.
Now,
so,
you talk
didn't
about,
bother me.
You talk okay. about them being unique, and can you explain a little bit? Because I know I've read that they're not big on the past and written traditions, and they're not like a lot of people who, the Jewish people, for instance, strong historical cultural background. We look at the past as a guiding light to the future, but it seems that the Roma aren't like that at all.
No, there is only the present tense in the Roma language. So one answer to my question about why would they steal the ashtrays was, while it's clear to me that they were going to be back in the hospital at some point, it's less clear to them. And certainly there is no Roma literature. There is no common understanding of the past. There's not really a lot of Roma history. The Roma have never conquered another country. They are not warlike. They don't have a Roma homeland, even though, philologists and historians will tell you that they're from India, not Egypt, which is what led to the gypsy name. They really are unique that way. They have a great musical tradition.
So,
Django Reinhardt, for example, was a Roma musician. But Scott,
I was going to ask you, having said that, one of the main characters in the book, Ferkel Rinsic, is the sole survivor and a witness. And that creates problems in and of itself, the trustworthiness of the witness. But why would he be interested in reliving the past through testimony and through being a witness, when apparently the whole basis of these people is to live in the present?
Right. Well, what Ferkel testifies to, and we're not giving away much since it's the first chapter of the book, is that his entire family was buried alive during this massacre, which he describes in the opening testimony that forms the prologue to the novel. So I would say he would have a reason to revisit that. A lot of grief and, of course, some desire for vengeance, even though the Roma don't, don't let grudges linger for generations.
Yeah, that makes sense. And of course, you know, he's human. You know, there's so many human people in this book, and that's one of the interesting things. And when we talk about Bill Ten Boom, which we just call him Boom, it's a great name. You talk about his kind of exploration sexually along the way and how he gets involved with his work, both from a legal perspective and a sexual perspective. Is that something that you think the midlife crisis brings out, or was it just all of the things going on in the book that create this kind of interesting dichotomy of an individual?
You know, I mean, for Ten Boom, there are a lot of different things going on, and his parents have died, but they imparted a family secret to him years before, and I think that more than anything else, having to come to terms with the fact that his parents were not who they always told him they were, is probably the single greatest cause. But you know, to some extent, he's also in this atmosphere, particularly when he gets to Bosnia, where as in many other places where terrible war crimes have taken place, where, you know, all kinds of restraint was abandoned. You know, there was savagery and constant rape, and it's, yeah, that is working on him too, I think, kind of what the atmosphere that he falls into. Not that he becomes a savage or anything like
right,
that,
right.
But it's a little hard to cling to Puritan mores in that kind of environment.
Do you ever write with the thought that this is going to be a motion picture, or do you just write as this is a novel?
The answer is I don't write novels thinking that they're going to become movies. And frankly, if that's what I was trying to do, I would never have written a book like Testimony, which, you know, is set in Europe, and that's kind of a no-no for American studios. I'm really interested in writing the best novels I can. And, you know, you guys live out there in L.A., and you know how many people are trying to guess what it is that the public wants.
Yeah.
And
right.
what the studios think the public wants. I'm not any good at that.
But there's more and more intrigue in international affairs now. I think more than ever, you know, America used to be pretty insular, but now they're exposed to a lot of things. You know, we just had a lot of things going on in Paris this week. Don't you think that this is a type of movie that someone would, a novel that someone would like to make a movie out of, to bring kind of the world together and to open up eyes of what goes on far, far away from here?
You know, to say the least, I would love it if somebody wants to make a movie out of this book. And do I think it would make a wonderful movie? Yeah, of course I do. Of course I do. I think there are, you know, there are great scenes there. And strong characters, and, you know, a fresh canvas as far as Hollywood is concerned.
Who would play Esma Czarny?
Ooh, what a great question. How about Selma Hayek?
Ooh. Yeah, that would bring people in. Very sultry.
Do you have any say when your films, you know, or when your novels get made into films? Do you have say about the casting, about what parts because of course they can't put the whole thing in there, but what it needs to be taken out and what doesn't?
My attitude is always that I'm like a 19th century child. I will speak when I am spoken to. So, if
if somebody wants my opinions, I will give them. But if I'm not, if I'm not asked, then I keep my mouth shut. And casting is, when Sidney Pollack was talking about making Presumed Innocent, the conversation was about certain stars. And then the studio got Harrison Ford to agree to read the book. There really wasn't a screenplay at that point. And he said he would do it. And at that point, it really didn't matter if anybody wanted Harrison or not. He had been in 5 of the 10 highest-grossing movies in history. It was a great coup that he was willing to do it. And, of course, as it turned out, he gave really fine performance.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that everybody anticipated that. But that you were not going to say no to Harrison Ford.
No, he was as hot as they came at that time and did a wonderful job. We have to take a quick break. I want to remind everyone that Scott Turow will be coming to L.A. He'll be in Santa Monica at the New Road School, Herb Albert Educational Village on Monday, this Monday, June 5th, and then Mission Viejo Library on Tuesday. Definitely come out and see Scott and get a signed book testimony. You're listening to Gervie's Law right here on Talk Radio 790 KBC.
News.
Talk.
Evolve. 790 KBC.
Have you or someone you know been injured on the job? Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers understand that physical and emotional workplace injuries severely impact your life. You have rights when injured at work, but you need an advocate to avoid getting lost in the red tape of a broken system. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers fully understand the complex workers' compensation system and will protect your rights if you've been injured on the job. RGW Lawyers won't give up when the insurance company fails you, and they have years of experience with catastrophic injuries like brain injuries, strokes, chemical exposure, cancers, and death. RGW Lawyers are compassionate and aggressive with over 40 years of advocacy for the rights of injured workers and have helped people change their lives with some of the largest settlements in California. You need someone in your corner if you're suffering from a work-related injury. Rowan, Gervie, and Wynn Lawyers will fight to get you the medical treatment you need. A workplace injury can happen at any time. Put this number in your phone now. 855-4-RGW-LAW. 855-4-RGW-LAW or go to rgwlawfirm.com.
Okay, Kevin, for the grand prize of $1 million, what color is the White House?
I know this.
5 seconds.
Oh, switching to Geico could save you a bunch of money on car insurance?
Okay, judges, that's true, Kevin. Bill alone, congratulations, you're a winner. Geico, because saving 15% or more on car insurance is always a great answer.
The following update is for drivers who pay too much for car insurance due to DUIs, DWIs, or anything else. Serenity Insurance specializes in low-cost SR22 or FR44 auto insurance. We've opened a phone line for very affordable car insurance meant specifically for overpaying high-risk drivers. The quote is free, and we'll handle the filings. Call 800-986-0694, 800-986-0694, 800-986-0694.
'Cause you had a bad day.
You had a long day at the office, got stuck in traffic, and spilled your dinner all over your front seat. But coming home to him makes it all worthwhile.
Oh, hi, buddy.
Find your next reason to come home at the 11th annual KABC Pet Adoption Day, Saturday, June 10th from 10 to 4 at the SPCA LAPD Pittsford Companion Animal Village in Long Beach. All adoptions include initial vaccinations, spaying or neutering, a free vet exam, microchip, and a free new pet parent pack from our friends at Subaru. The 11th annual KABC Pet Adoption Day, brought to you by the all-new 2017 Subaru Impreza. It's more than a car. It's a Subaru. Get all the details at KABC.com.
We got a real big
show for you.
Coming up on the next Drive Home with Jillian Barbary and John Phillips, we'll tell you if anyone else fired Kathy Griffin over the weekend.
Plus, if you've got a recent tattoo, a fresh tattoo, you might not want to go swimming. We'll tell you why.
Live and local right after Dr. Drew and Mike Catherwood right here on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Welcome back to Gervie's Law, turning Murphy's Law upside down on Talk Radio 790 KABC.
Yes. We are back. We're talking to Scott Turow and his most recent book, Testimony. Washington Post wrote, Testimony is a tour de force of collapsing perceptions. And, of course, the first book he wrote before Presumed Innocent, The Burden of Proof, Identical, and the Others was 1L. And I do want to talk a little bit more about Testimony, but, you know, I don't want to forget because 1L is such an important book. This is a legal show fundamentally, even though last week, who did we have on the show? Michael Anthony Hall?
Yes,
and,
we
and
did.
And the week before was Anson Williams. So we've been going for actors, and now we have, of course, Scott is a lawyer. But you wrote 1L, and the New York Times wrote a wonderful book. It should be read by anyone who has ever contemplated going to law school or anyone who has ever worried about being human. And that's what's so great about 1L is it's not just about law school, it's about being human. How did that come to you and why did you, and I, of course you mentioned earlier that you wanted to be a novelist, but how did you get motivated at Harvard Law School when, you know, you were preoccupied with trying to get through that place?
Well, the story of 1L is actually fairly comic. I decided to go to law school while I was teaching on the very bottom rung of the faculty at Stanford. I was teaching creative writing, and I had an opportunity to go on with academic life, but I really was fascinated with law, and I wanted to go to law school. So I had a literary agent, and I just didn't know how to make it sound sincere that I really wanted to go on with my literary ambitions, even though I was going to law school. And so I said, you know, would be a great idea if somebody wrote a book about a about the daily life of a law student. And she didn't really read my letter closely enough to notice that I wasn't talking about writing the book myself. And she went out to lunch, and I think she and the editor who bought it had too much to drink, and So I ended up with a contract to write the book. But as I said, the editor was probably inebriated, and eventually when I finished the book, he called me up and he said, you know, I want you to just remind me of one thing. I said, what is it? He said, why did I ever want to buy this book? And at that point, I had to sort of sell him the book again. And I made all these proclamations about how Americans had, you know, all of this interest in the law in the wake of Watergate. And you know, ultimately it turned out to be true. And that's part of what has given 1L its currency, even 40 years later.
Yeah, it's a timeless book. And were you surprised at the response? Because I think, you know, a lot of people have read it with interest, especially, of course, law students and lawyers, but others as well.
Yes, I was surprised. I had written one unpublished novel after another in those days. And to have a book contract in the first place was shocking. And then to have, you know, great reviews in the New York Times and Newsweek and the other places that wrote about 1L was, the whole thing was astonishing, only exceeded by what happened 10 years later with Presumed Innocent.
Right, with Presumed Innocent and the movie and everything. And then you flash forward 40 years from 1L and tell us about the response to Testimony. How have you felt about that response, which is obviously very new?
I felt wonderful about it. And I don't, you know, I don't think I ever allowed myself to think what a challenging book this was to write. You know, obviously, I had to learn a lot of stuff about the Roma and about the International Criminal Court in The Hague and about the Balkan War. And the fact that, you know, reviewers have been as universal as they have in praising the book, and, you know, it's on the bestseller list. It's selling very well. You know, that's all really, really gratifying. And I looked at my wife when, you know, we got the first week sales figures. And I said, you know, 30 years as a best-selling novelist, that's pretty good.
Yeah, I would say that. You know, and the other thing is, you know, you thought that you couldn't beat the feelings of the Cubs winning the World Series last year, and then out comes the book.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that testimony to my inner 6-year-old will ever equal the thrill of seeing the Cubs finally win the World Series.
And do you think your father is smiling down, appreciating the Cubs' victory? As much as your success as a writer, I'm sure the Cubs' victory is something important to him as well.
Oh, for sure. Although my father, being my father, is, you know, would be walking around heaven going, naturally, as soon as I'm gone, then they win.
There you go. Yeah, that's, I think we can all identify with that. When you go to the town hall meetings, and, you know, you're going to be in Santa Monica on Monday at New Road School, Herb Albert Educational Village, and you're going to be on Tuesday at Mission Viejo Library. Tell us what someone can expect and what the experience is like being there with Scott Turow.
You know, I think that we'll have a conversation probably very much like the one the three of us have had today. I'll talk about the sources for the book. Maybe I'll read a little bit about it. I'm sure I'll talk about my career and maybe talk a little bit about the strange life of wearing two hats, being both a practicing lawyer and a novelist. And a lot of the conversation at the end of the day, Ellen, gets driven by the audience and the stuff that they're curious about. So, you know, it's not all within my control, and that's a good thing.
And how do people get tickets to get there?
I think, and I'm a little out of my depth, but I think it's something called brown paper tickets. Does that ring a bell with you guys?
Yes, yes, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. So it's brown paper tickets.
I think
so.
That's
Google,
right, yeah.
Google that. Go ahead, Carrie.
I just want to know what's next. What, you know, do you have any books in your head, things that you've wanted to get out on paper? What's next for you?
Yeah, I've got an idea for a new novel. I'm not really quite talking about it yet, but, you know, I've got an idea. I'm going back to Kendall County, which is my imaginary hometown.
Right, right.
And I'll probably be writing about a character that readers have met before. And I think I'm going to deal with the world of big science and big pharma.
Good.
I would be interested in big pharma because I think it's a big problem. And I hope that you can really bring some thrills and some suspense to that, because I think, you know, what's interesting about your books is there's always an underlying theme. It's not just the suspense. And, you know, Kendall County is a place where I think a lot of people need to go and experience the different aspects of life. You know, we really appreciate the fact that you've taken the time on your busy schedule. I know you've got an event tonight in Wisconsin.
I do.
You know, the book is called Testimony, and it's a great read. I'm sure a lot of people who are listening today want to read it. If you want to see Scott and talk to him, I mentioned the two places he'll be this week in L.A., in Santa Monica and Mission Viejo. Good luck with that. We're going to be looking forward to a new book, I'm sure, in a little while. But let's enjoy not only the Cubs' victory, but also the book Testimony, and, of course, the Rock Bottom Remainders. Do you have any gigs coming up with Dave Barry?
We did, and the sponsors canceled, and it must be that they've heard us play before.
So,
That's funny because I know Dave Barry said it's like if Metallica were writing a novel, that's about how it'd come out. So that goes, that's consistent. But we'll look forward to the Rock Bottom Remainders. Of course, they're a group of best-selling authors raising money for literacy charities. Scott Turow, thanks so much for being on Gervie's Law today.
Thank you.
Alan Ferry, thank you both for so much time. It's great to talk to you.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. And that's going to do it for our show today. I want to thank Carrie for being here, Scott for being on the phone. What a great show.
Yeah, he's awesome.
He was awesome. Go out and get testimony, and we will see you right here next week on Gervie's Law.